This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good morning, everyone, and I'm especially appreciative for all of you who have made it after the conference dinner last night. I would also like to give a particularly warm welcome to all of the people at the museums who've assisted me, and I see quite a number of you here in the audience, so I'd like to thank you for that support, and also for all the y'all new who have assisted me, who I think are probably still sleeping. So we will carry on. The forgotten collection of fiber objects from the expedition reveals histories that connect people, place, and time. It's the collecting of Frederick McCarthy and Frank Zetzler which is integral to this study. You can see them here in their respective photos of each other. Many material culture items collected from the expedition were made entirely from prepared or manipulated fiber. And you'll see here some of the raw fiber that was actually collected. There were other types of fiber used, such as fur, feathers, human hair, and wool, all spun into string, while other plants like Pandanus spirillus were made into baskets. Sally May and her pivotal research has provided us with a number, which many of us researchers have leapt upon, of 2,144 ethnographic items collected on the expedition. Based on my research, the total number of fiber objects, I'm just talking about the fiber objects from the exhibition, should be 656. And this is actually 30.5% of the entire ethnographic collection is made from fiber. You'll see one of the reasons in this chart why I've selected Melingimbi as a case study. Not only did Melingimbi have the most fiber objects collected there, but it's also a place where I've spent a fair amount of time and have a considerable knowledge base from which to work. Other reasons include the collection rationale and the methodology of McCarthy and Zetzler away from the expedition team. On Friday, the 30th of July, Reverend Tom Hanna rode up on his horse and cart to collect McCarthy and Zetzler. You'll see there are a few other people here to greet as well. That's Bapa Sheppy, I believe, there, and some other people in the background. For their three-week stay, these men were free from the direct and daily influence of Mountford, but were constrained by systems he had put into place. The two men spent most of their time engaged in archaeological work, mainly at the Macassan Well and Wallaby Mound. The remainder of their time, other than writing and marking specimens, was spent in collecting ethnographic items. Their collection approach and methodology was influenced by the attitudes, beliefs, and work of a whole group of men. They included the American anthropologist William Lloyd Warner, the Reverends Hannah and Elmore, and most importantly, a group of Aboriginal men. Warner's work from 1927 to 29 was a guide not only for the Melingimbi collection and archaeological work, but it was also used at the base camps as well. At Yirrkala, McCarthy was actually using Warner's material culture items as a guide for directing Aboriginal people to make specimens. Zetzler commented, I quote, "It all seems backwards, but this is our only method for obtaining ethnological specimens." It does seem odd that Melingimbi-based material culture from the 1920s was being reproduced by men in communities whose styles were quite different. This photograph of the missionary Tom Hanna and his family. He was one of the missionaries that worked at Melingimbi. The other one was Elmore. Both of these men had established prices for material culture items, and this fact had a very strong impact on the men's collecting at Melingimbi. McCarthy and Zetzler were using the goods provided by Mountford of tobacco, a few combs, mirrors, and razor blades for trade. McCarthy pointed out that it would have been far better for them if Mountford had provided items the people actually wanted, such as knives, tomahawks, shorts, shirts, and belts. McCarthy notes in his diary that trading by Zetzler sometimes got them into difficult trouble due to previously set standards by the missions. This is a quote from his diary. In addition, Hannah points out after Zetzler had got some fine spears and baskets that we should be paying more than we are for these specimens. We are now in an awkward situation. We want a good collection, and we will have to pay a lot for it because of the mission standards, and we will have to make up on the bark paintings. Now for some of the Aboriginal men who worked with Zetzler and McCarthy. They were absolutely crucial to their success, as they would have brought material culture items to trade, or would they would have others come and visit them after work. On August the 10th, both men photographed some of these men. Ruth Naumakara Garawura and Joe Niparanga Gumbala have helped me and given me the updated spellings and other names for the men as they are now remembered in the community. In addition to these workers, both men mention Harry Makawala and his son Jackie, giving him great assistance. I also like to mention that Harry Makawala was the main person that worked with Lloyd Warner. So you see a continuation of roles of people. But perhaps this next image is one of my more exciting things that I've managed to do at Melingimbi. We now have the names of every single family member from Harry's family. Zetzler was very disapproving of Mountford's methods for obtaining material culture, which often involved getting men from other areas to produce work by direction. Circumstances were quite different at Melingimbi. This is a quote. Many specimens coming in are not those made to order, so to speak, but the actual specimens which they use in their everyday life. This turns out by far the best procedure, to purchase or trade for the things of their culture we desire, rather than have a group of natives fed by us make new things as we direct, rather than get the objects they actually use. This is a more orthodox way of collecting, I feel. Their collecting at Melingimbi did appear to have been completed, as Zetzler described. Whether or not this was based solely on a conscious decision to do so, or came about because they had little time after their archaeological work to engage people, is not totally clear. But they did feel that collecting everyday items was a better method than setting up artificial situations to obtain, quote, real ethnological specimens. From Zetzler's diary, he appeared to be doing a lot of his trading with tobacco. By August the 8th, some disagreements were occurring between the two men in regards to the collecting process. This is from McCarthy's diary of August the 8th. His attitude to get specimens as cheaply as possible, such as a basket for one stick of tobacco, but I believe that these poor natives should be given some reasonable value for the great amount of work involved in making a netted bag, twine, basket, and spear. We are paying more for bark paintings, which take very little time, than for the objects which take a lot of time and trouble. McCarthy had a strong interest in fiber objects and an appreciation of the time required in their construction. He realized the makers were not being compensated equally for their work. Regardless of the disagreements and their lack of funding, their trading continued throughout the trip. They proved to be very popular with people on the mainland as well as for those who came to trade items. After 10 days, McCarthy was very positive about the virtues of being at Melingimbi. He and Zetzler were happy with their collecting and their work. McCarthy wrote in his diary that Melingimbi should certainly have been the base camp instead of Yirrkala. Before beginning this discussion of some of the fibre objects, I want to reflect on what Gifford Miller said yesterday in reference to the eggshells that he was studying. He suggested that perhaps we should learn to listen to the eggshells instead of asking them to speak. So I would very much agree with him and like to say the same thing about the group of objects that I work with. I've grouped, and again this is my grouping, of the fiber items that were collected into these categories which you see on the screen, and you'll see the numbers of all the items there. And this is applicable, these categories, to all the fiber objects collected at all of the base camps as well as Melingimbi. Just go back one. In the bodywear here, you will see all the different types of objects, but the most dominant one were the armbands. And these are the four main types of armbands that you will see in the collection. You'll have the wrapped ones, interlaced, feathered, and the woven ones, which are actually the second category there. Also in bodywear, belts are dominant, human hair belts, interlaced ones. The necklaces, you'll see quite a few grass stem necklaces, very similar to the one I'm wearing today. In the other items that people wore, we have pubic covers, and some of you may have a vague memory from Adrienne Kepler's talk. This is the piece from Groot Island that was seen in the very edge of her slide. It's a fantastic bark dress from Groot. Incredible headdresses, like this one from Melingimbi, and also this chest harness, breast harness, or matka. Containers are also a very large portion of the collection, and you can see here how many of each particular type, and I'll then go through some of those. With the baskets, and these are twined baskets, we basically have three categories. They're the plain ones with no added ochre or adornment. They're ochred ones, and they're ones that have feathers or other attachments to them. For string bags, there are two types. We have these, I call them flat string bags, because when they're not in use, they are rather flat. And then on the other side of the screen are what's known as biting bags, power bags, spirit bags. There's a long list of names, but these are stuffed and then tied together at the top. We also have a range of containers made from various kinds of bark. The folded and stitched ones, there's an example downstairs in the beautiful display from here. That particular one on the screen is from Gumbalanya. You have the bark baskets that are pleated on the ends, like the one you see from Groot. And also you have the very ephemeral paper bark ones that are just tied together at the ends. So all of these are represented. I had, you may have noticed, a category called Other. Other are items that there are seven or less in the entire collection. And there are a range of things, but I've just selected to put up one of the beautiful propeller toys for you and a shuttle already wound with feathered string ready to be used to make into something. Now, this chart is a comparison between the ethnology register, which is held at IATSIS here, and if you go through the register, there should be 312 items collected from Melingimbi. This excludes the bark paintings, which is a whole other story. Of this number, 127 items were fiber ones. Now, what you see in the chart, the blue is what's in the register, and the orange is what I've actually found, and you can see they don't quite match up, which I think has been a problem for most researchers. But it is very exciting in some cases, very rare, like in the string bags. I've actually found one more than they said they collected, which is very pleasing. But usually, there are, and also with the armbands, you'll see there are more armbands. But usually it's either the same or less. Now, what's happened to these missing items? I think this is a thing that a lot of us have tried to come to terms with. For the fiber objects, there are a few possibilities to explain their absences. Some have been registered and subsequently lost. Some are listed as missing, location pending, or in the case of the exciting collection at the Australian Museum, one was actually stolen while on loan to the Commonwealth Department of Trade. And the one that you see on the screen, I've been in correspondence with the Hood Museum in Dartmouth College in America. They've sent me these beautiful images. This is a basket that was actually exchanged in 1951. So I have found some of these things, but some have been incorrectly attributed, and some may have been kept by Mountford or any of the other members and not actually made it into the collections. Now I'd like to talk to you a bit about some of the exceptions. This basket from the Smithsonian, this coiled basket, is one of the exceptions. When I say exceptions, unusual within the group of items collected. It's a coiled basket, and it's one that Setzler himself acknowledges as one for trade and not a traditional technique. For me, this epitomizes Setzler's methodology of collecting what people were making and using rather than commissioning pieces at Melingimbi. In addition to this coiled basket, McCarthy was also collecting fiber items that were classic in form but incorporated manufactured materials. These items would not have been considered real ethnographic specimens by most members on the expedition. The most common occurrence of outside materials was the use of colored wool. Objects of this type were also collected at Melingimbi, but I show you these beautiful Groot ones in hopes that the Groot people would be here to see these. Also, we have, this is a Melingimbi one, red wool for armband. You will see at the bottom of this basket, red wool. This basket from Melingimbi incorporates a fabric handle. And one of my favorite pieces from the Australian Museum is this beautiful binding bag. Not only does it have the red wool, it has these beautiful fluoro buttons. Now, I'd like to just quickly wrap up with some examples of what these things actually mean to people at Melingimbi and other places. The wonderful woman that you see here is Laurie Baimawanga, a Malara woman. She's one of the most senior people at Melingimbi. And she's looking at some of the baskets held in various collections here. And I have a quote from the now-deceased Melingimbi Shire Council liaison officer, and he says, "She can tell. She can see the pattern differences." Indeed, he was referring, and she was referring, to the designs on baskets from the expedition that she grouped into moiety divisions of Dua and Yiricha. For example, in the baskets from Melingimbi, 60% of these have ochre designs, such as the one you see here. And for those keen observers, you'll note that this one has been beautifully mended. But the photographs taken at Melingimbi have been an essential component of the research. By working closely with Niporanga Gumbala and now Makara Garawara, identifications have been made of many individuals. For example, these three women. You'll notice on top of their stacks of wood is pandanus. So more than likely, these three women also made baskets, which could possibly have been made and collected. There are other women that we've now identified. You can see here. I'm very keen to fill in the blank spaces. And this last photograph is a particularly interesting one for me. This one has been looked at over and over for about a year now, and in that time period, I'm very pleased to say, we now have this many people known, and the people who are in italics are still alive today. Now, this particular photograph, you'll notice that there is a man at the far end painting a basket. Well, in discussions with one of my wonderful research assistants who's in the audience today, I was trying to explain to her, why am I doing this stuff? Why are you sitting here attaching all this information? And I said, just look at this photograph here, you know. Look, you see that basket? Let's see if we can find it. So we went on a search, and believe it or not, I found the basket, based on all sorts of rationale, which if someone's really interested, I can explain to you how I found the basket. But this is the basket here. Not only do we find the basket, we know who it is. This is Mungunu Gekamanga. This is one of Niparanga's uncles. So this has provoked much, much discussion with Niparanga and his family about the fate, if you'd like, of this basket. For example, in February of this year, when I met with him to show him this discovery, after looking at the photographs, he asked, could he please see this basket in black and white, which I could easily do for him. And then it was like this recognition went off, and he was very, very excited. So he says, quote, "This is a very important basket. Only the elders can carry on." Now, later on this year in October, he said he'd like to do more consultation with people at Melingimbi and would, quote, "probably sign to get it back." Without doubt, there are many other baskets that fall into this category. But I'd just like to leave you with some thoughts here. This is Niparanga and Naumakara at Melingimbi, looking at photographs and talking about these people, what this expedition meant to them, and also the kinds of questions that this expedition has managed to stir up. And I think Ray Speck kind of summed it up nicely with his presentation. There are many questions that need answering, and they're going to take a lot of time. So I hope that we do have time for a few questions. And while we're doing that, I'll be flicking through just a few composite images of things from Melingimbi. Thank you.
Now, we do have some questions. Time's a little, we're going to hit the airwaves at 9:50. So we do have 7 minutes.
I can see why you're such a sleuth. The objects are superb. I wanted to ask you about when you believe the cultural exchange in regard to the coiled baskets took place. I know the Arundhati from South Australia do something similar, and I'm wondering whether the genesis is there.
I think you're asking me, when did people start trading coiled baskets, or when did people start making them?
The knowledge, yeah. When was the knowledge transferred?
You'll have to read my paper later, but it's highly detailed in there and other publications that I've written. But really, this is pretty much a missionary involvement, and Greta Matthews is the person most likely attributed to bringing the coiled technique actually from the southeast Aboriginal people that her family worked with to Goulburn, and then the technique spread.
So the source is probably the knowledge came from Victoria, is that what you're saying?
And South Australia.
Thank you. Louise,
Diana Laidlaw, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your reference to McCarthy and his statement that about paying more for bark paintings which take little effort compared to bark basketry. And I wanted to make a reference to Belinda Scott, who's here today and has worked at Ramangini for some 10 years. I understand it is still an issue, what is paid to women and basket work compared to now canvas work and paintings. And perhaps Belinda, put on the spot, might also have a comment.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, there are several art advisors here in the audience, and I'm sure they can regale you with lots of prices and comparisons and so forth, but it's always been the case. And it's not just because it's women. It has to do with the perceived persona of the objects as being domestic and not art.
Hello, I am Belinda Scott. Thanks, Diane Laidlaw, for that. I think it's not only in terms of within the Indigenous craft area. It's the fine line between the difference between what's art and what's craft, and it's not only restricted to the difference in payment is not only restricted to in terms of Indigenous communities, but I have been put on the spot. I also think that in terms of the surplus value of paintings, that actually accrues over time. And what you're doing here is bringing... I'm trying to speak from a Marxist perspective. I hope people understand what I'm trying to say. But what I'm saying is that in your rediscovering or bringing to light the value of these collections, while at the time it still does continue that the payment was different... In a sense, it's largely because that practice still continues, it's still not really about the money. It's still the fact that these beautiful objects were collected and they're still around these days.
Ian Dunlop, thank you for a beautiful presentation. I was interested in the biting bags.
Yes.
I've never seen anything like this at Yirrkala. I was wondering, is this something that's gone out of use today? And I mean, it seemed to me that the shape of them would make biting much more difficult than the biting bags, which are more like conventional bags that I've seen at Yirrkala.
Well, I could talk a long time about those, but that's another area that I've given other papers on, just those bags. I've been looking at them from early times, 1924 with Wilkins up till now. And I think the last time I did this, we had a wonderful contribution from Kim McKenzie because he gave me an image of someone as recently as, you know, in the 70s actually using one of these. And, for example, Niparanga, who's not with us at the moment, he says he still has Jawas, ones that were given to him, which occasionally come out. So we can have a longer discussion about those if you like.
Louise, it's Sarah Bunn speaking. I just wanted, could you, while that image is up, point out the different moieties, the doer and the richer, with the images that are there?
I don't think I have time for that.
Just a few,
and I need
please.
My notes from Bemawanga with me. But it is... but this one, for example, this one is a Gopalpuinga one, obviously Yiricha. That diamond patterning is quite often associated with Yiricha moiety clans. And I did kind of do a big clan listing in the paper, but no time for that here. And actually, just like to mention, I'm just now at the point where I can leap off and really do something with these objects because I've been spending... you know, a year or more, just trying to collect them so I'd know what's actually there. So I'm going to be very excited to now to go back to Melingimbi and hopefully to these other communities with something much more concrete to show them.
I'm just fascinated with... I would like to know what Frank Setzler's charter was from the Smithsonian, because he was employed as an archaeologist and he had to, when we were at Yirrkala, there were no possible digs except at Port Bradshaw and Milangimbi, and those were Macassan documents. But as a member of the expedition, we were not concerned with the Aboriginal artefacts. We were told we couldn't collect them either for ourselves or for the expedition. Now, here we have a whole set. The people, all we had, I had, were a few sticks of tobacco. What was Frank Setzler's role in this? McCarthy had a much more liberal role because he was only a pair of hands to help Frank and Margaret MacArthur and others.
Oh, that's a very interesting question, but of course we know, and there's a lot of Australian museum and Smithsonian people here, but for McCarthy, it was part of his goal was to collect for the museum material culture items, and he knew what was in his collection, so he was looking for particular things. In terms of Frank Setzler, Smithsonian people can certainly disagree or whatever with his statement, but part of the role for Setzler was also to bring back a collection because, as Adrian Kepler pointed out, the Smithsonian had a tradition of collecting things, but they had very little, really, in compared to other institutions. So they actually wanted a big material culture collection to go back to the Smithsonian. And any Smithsonian person want to comment on that?
Do you want to, Adrian?
No, I just agree with you.
Yeah, because we're actually on the knocker now for the satellite link up with Ian. Thank you once again very much. I had lots of things I wanted to say too, but.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.